Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the second episode of Inside History, May to June 2016. I'm reading through it. The last one, I'm aiming for 50 minutes. The last one's only 10 minutes, so I was called away. But interestingly, I'm doing all this for cardiac rehab. And there's the friendly telephone service and sort of checking on weight and stuff like that. And so I obviously had to break for a while to speak to the chap there. And then I got out the exercise bike, did a few repairs to it. And God, I've got to add that to the regimen at the moment. So I've still got a long way to go, but hopefully this cognitive stuff has improved. Now, this area is on, I'm talking about now, is the history online. There are various, what they call apps. Now, this is really interesting. My definition of an app is that it's got to have some PHP or some computer program functionality, JavaScript or something that it actually does something. So a website is a static document, whereas an app has some sort of element of computer power used in it. Now, of course, the stuff that I produce is an app, really an app emulator. The apps that I produce with all these little drop-down buttons, each button just links to another page. So it looks as though it's a computer function, but it's really not. So the computer function's outside it, and so it does the sort of filtering of the data in a fraction of a second once on the server, and then you get the standalone package here. So here they are calling a few things that I'd call just websites, apps. Okay, so ES is Everly Stories. There's four of them, so just read it through. Though hardly hallowed by the passing of times, these apps and websites harness the latest technology to help you link with the past in an informative, interesting way. Sarah Trevor road tests four of the latest to see how they are. So this is saying, look, this is not historical, but they're hardly hallowed or old or anything like that, because they're up. So how come they're in a history magazine? Well, they're portals to that. So I wouldn't necessarily call them an app. Everly Stories, now have a free desktop compatible. Sydney's Everly Railway Yards are regarded as some of the finest historical rail workshops in the world. This website shares the heritage and stories of this historic precinct, tracing the starts paths from prehistoric, pre-European history through to World War II and beyond. Everly Stories explores the site's former uses as wetlands and home to the Gundagai people, to the colonial era paddocks of Major Cleveland, and, of course, the railway yards themselves. Everly Stories is an engaging website which really brings the precincts to life. Visit everlystory.com.au. Okay. So, I must admit that I set up a little robotics company. They had little robots in the the sheds, and so it was a very interesting, the modern story of it's quite interesting, besides the old story, and you'd be able to go up and, about 50 metres away, people will be restoring these ancient trains and stuff like that. Well, one of the things that occurs to me is that this seems a very good thing for, I know, Aboriginal people who have got a complete historic reconstruction of the world without, based on historical stuff. So, and they've got actually a real functioning website. Apps for it. So really should link it in with these people. And again, they have to say map the entire Everly area, and you can walk around it as in a prehistoric historic recreation of it. So I think there's an obvious overlap there. I'll actually put this podcast out to my friend Brett Levy. Brett, mate. There's a big opening for you to actually come in and interact with the Aboriginal history online with your app. I think they should do a big feature story on you. So this is a group. So I'm not the only person struggling away. There are these other groups struggling away to produce and just not getting anywhere in Australian society. So there's robot groups, robotics groups, which are just shut out, and there's also this Aboriginal group having a recreation, and I think there's strong historical stories for it here as well. Okay, that's the first of four. This is the second of four, called Kint Mapper, desktop free compatible. Now, KinMapper is a nifty app that maps locations where your ancestors lived over the generations. After logging in to your family's search account, the app updates the world map with pins indicating every place mentioned in your ancestors' records, birth, marriages, deaths, indeed any mention of a location. The result helps you visualize where your ancestors lived and see lists of your ancestors linked to a particular location. However, you need to re-research with family research to use KinMapper. The more information about your ancestors you have on family search, the more valuable the app will be to you. So that's an interesting aspect. And again, as I've sort of said before, there's a whole heap of ethical problems that you may have a certain reason for, and other people can access or reconstruct the information there. It's very interesting. Tap Genes, free desktop compatible. The winner of this year's Roots Tech Innovator Showdown, Tap Genes, is an ambitious app that brings together genealogy and health. Oh dear. It aims to help you build a more accurate, thorough picture of your family's medical history by sharing your health information such as allergies, medications, test results and even doctor's notes with your family members. It calculates your individual health risks using simple quizzes to collect your health information. TapGenes is an innovative app, and so long as your family members are comfortable sharing their medical history, a nifty tool as well. Oh dear. Nottingham Caves, a free iOS Android compatible. And this is great because my daughters have been to Nottingham. It's one of these things that you don't understand, Nottingham and caves, not the two things that Aussies would put together. Peel back the layers in history of Nottingham, UK, with a fascinating guide detailing 5 kilometre walk around Nottingham's man-made caves. The caves are rich and varied, from a medieval malting factory to a dungeon with reputed links to Robin Hood, and with the famous Mortimer hole through which Edward III's soldiers captured Roger de Mortimer, to name a few highlights. Well, I have to understand that. Roger de Mortimer, see if I can memorize that one. Using cutting-edge archaeological scanning technology, Nottingham Cave Trail boasts images, panoramas, floor plans, videos. The app will expand as new caves are explored. Basically, wouldn't it be nice if it had virtual reality tacked into that? Okay. Now, going through here, here is an article called, by David Payne, Universe in a Pocket Watch. It's a mystery that eluded the best scientific minds for centuries. How to find longitude so ships could accurately plot a course across the seas. David Payne, curator of the Australian National Maritime Museum, he looks at the new expedition, Ships, Clocks and Stars, and traces twists in the skullduggery that made the discovery so fascinating. This is really interesting because it is really unknown that Captain Cook completely looked at the motion of moons around Jupiter to map the coast of Australia. He didn't use clocks, Harrison's clocks. He didn't use them. We did, but he had such a better tool, the astronomical thing. Longitude is your location, east and west direction around the world, and it can be determined by any point of the point just by using the time. But calculating the difference between the time at your location and the time at another location, you can locate your longitude. It's such an elegant solution. Two times ceases the difference between the two times, and you know where you are. But remember, longitude is not the point. It's only a line running north to south. North to south. And you are somewhere on that line. The history is a simple idea being accepted is full of practical clock-making difficulties that had to be overcome so that clocks could be reliable at sea. Then there was a composition that came from complicated celestial calculations and some completely mad ideas that were promoted by other interests. Now, the celestial calculations actually won the day. Good old Captain Cook, if you actually look at it. So the Endeavour went out and discovered, or quote-unquote discovered, Australia. Captain Cook was something which made the astronomical things really work, because he was super smart. Well, I don't know, strange, I think, is the word I'd call them nowadays. Much of this comes to life in the exhibition Ships, Clocks and Stars on show at the Australian National Museum, National Maritime Museum, the ANMM, so named because at the end of Renaissance ships were square-rigged, not very manoeuvrable and hard to sail, and when they sailed out to the ocean, they were unable to locate the east-west position with any degree of certainty, facing ever-present danger of shipwrecks. Clocks worked on land, but it took a genius with perseverance to create a timepiece needed to be reliable use in seas. Stars, the ones that could be seen, all had names, but there were problems of observing position of the stars, the planets and sun accurately. Or then, calculating the locations relative to the Earth to help find your own location was a tedious task, yes, taking several hours. Locating your longitude can be considered a relatively modern problem in the story of human travels, and universal agreement on how to plot it on a chart was only established in the 1840s. For generations, sailors from many seafaring locations had kept largely to the coast, and if they were out of sight of land, it was only for a short period. On the 15th century onwards, locating a ship's longitude at sea became a significant issue for the largely European sailors making passages, trade routes, to and from domains still relatively new to them. They had begun to traverse the major oceans using routes that ventured well out of sight of familiar landmarks. They had charts, but locating accurately where they were on the charts when there was no land in sight to relate the present problem. Beautifully put together. What a beautiful putting it together. He's taking it nice and slow. He's written out the key points and expanded them. Beautifully put together. I hope I can do this. There were reliable ways of determining latitude, the location north and south of the equator. But how far the ship had travelled east or west along the line led to some attitude of dead reckoning. Estimation made poor and often unreliable sources of information. The concern was heightened by the obvious danger of grounding on known but distant continental or island shores, another hazardous that were on and not on the chart might be just beyond the horizon. Let's not forget some of the other passage makers in open waters, notably the Polynesians, whose concept of navigation was not in terms of a grid or longitude. They understood their location from the stars and sky, with which which to them was the chart on display every night. By putting themselves directly under a star and heading with the wind along the star's line, they could keep on their own known course. Yeah, there's also the wave, that they have those wave baskets they had. I hope they mentioned this. They also used estimation of speeds to figure out how far they might have travelled. But in addition, they had accumulated generations of knowledge, observation of winds, waves and environment to pick up signs of lands well in advance of appearing. Well, that's glad that I mentioned that. They were less concerned about always knowing at the exact point in the ocean they were able to recognise the signs of land even though it was not visible. The knowledge was passed on with the confidence they sailed on the highways between islands, navigating the deck with their charts surrounding them and the key to unlocking them in their head. But it's those special wave baskets that they made, which is just insane. I wish they could talk about it, but I wish they expanded that. The sailor of the early modern periods did not possess these observation abilities to the same degree and same confidence, especially on unfamiliar territories. The Renaissance brought humans many steps forward in technologies and sailors becoming more reliant on scientific instruments linked to tables of calculations, along with charts divided by grid lines and points marked on intersections. Their approach to the longitude problem was to seek a solution that was increasingly worked out below decks with pen and paper. The number of proposals were put forward to locate longitude, and clearly mad ones, such as using light ships anchored at close intervals across oceans, was easily dismissed. It was only possible in theory And in practice on land, to estimate longitude using tedious complicated calculations from celestial observations of Jupiter's moon. Thank you, Galileo. But, oh, and they've got a picture of Galileo up there. Okay. Other celestial-based solutions were considered, but these could all yield potentially unreliable results, even assuming no mathematical mistakes were made. A favourite method in many quarters was the lunar distance. Relying on observations of the Earth's moon, it took decades of work to understand the moon's pattern of movement to a point that predictions could be made and considered even reasonably reliable. As well, until the octant and sextants were refined further, it was impractical to accurately measure the angles between the calculations. In parallel with the documentation used to use the stars and the moon, the solution through the use of clocks was well enough known. I do have to mention that they had the calculators and the anti-calculators. They had four calculators and four anti-calculators, and I don't know what the calculators and anti-calculators were in Britain, and they just raced ahead of time to get the books ready and printed for Captain Cook before he set off. In parallel to the determination of the use of the moons, solution through the use of clocks was well enough known. It had been brought up in the early 1500s and periodically resurfaced. The easier part was telling the time where you were without a timepiece. This could be done reasonably accurately with existing technology. Observing the sun and noting when it was briefly at its highest point in the sky enabled you to calculate midday at your location. The problem was the second element needed, carrying the time of the day from another location with you. That was needed was a timepiece that remained accurate to a second for a very long period. Many months was desirable, but a couple of years was the ultimate goal. The solution came in a series of timepieces designed and built by George Harrison, the Yorkshire-based clockmaker. After overcame a wide range of practical problems due to materials, mechanical actions of the machinery, marine environment, and the outside influence of the ship's rapid and seemingly random movements, all aimed at a timepiece that maintained a regular, even beat for each second. What I was going to say was that they had the person's observation chair, which was supposed to go against, remove the rocking of the sea. Meanwhile, as he perfected his clock-making approach, both the tables and instruments needed for lunar distance were coming together in a usable manner as well. A competition between the I don't think Cook used lunar distance, I think he used Jupiter as well. The competition between the two was exacerbated in 1714 Longitude Act that offered a substantial reward for the accepted solution, along with a fortune waiting to be claimed where the inevitable politics, personalities, pride of people fought to be the winner. All these elements served to make the route to the final solution contorted, poisoned, frustrating for all involved. In the face of this, Harrison persisted and perfected over 5 decades. The first 3 of his timepieces were bulky. While they worked in theory, fundamental flaws prevented them from working in the ship, and they looked awkward relative to his timepiece of 1759, known as H4. A breakthrough instrument was really a big watch. This original, plus 3 replicas of his early instruments, are among the highlights of the A&M exhibition. H4 size and accuracy, subsequent nautical timepieces that followed, known as chronometers, finally made the difference. This is a practical method for calculating meridian and longitude. The ships had their clocks, and the clocks were set to one star, the sun. The lines of longitude were called meridians, and these are relatively easy to visualize and understand. They are virtual circles around the Earth passing through the north and south poles that allow us to divide the parallel lines or circles of latitude into equal divisions. They look like lines dividing a peel of orange into segments, each meridian of longitude the same diameter, whereas the circles of latitude decrease in diameter away from the equator. Now, this is really beautifully put, beautifully written, this person. Congratulations for putting a beautiful article together. By convention, the position of any point on Earth is located by meridian of longitude and is parallel to latitude. Each meridian is perpendicular to all circles of latitude. As noted, each meridian is also the same length and equals the circumference of the Earth, as each meridian is a great circle dividing the Earth into equal hemispheres. The term meridian comes from the Latin word to midday. Oh, that's interesting. Mercuries, highlighted again with the connection of the sun and how it can give an exact time at one point each day. When the sun crosses directly above each meridian midway between the times of sunrise and sunset, it is a midday for that meridian. Midday became the datum as appeared as remained constant, which the length of the day between the sunrise and sunset quite obviously varies throughout the year. So those times are also variable. Midday, and it's interesting that time used to be 12 hours a day, but it was 6 hours from midnight to sunrise, 6 hours from sunrise to midday, and 6 hours, it was divided into 24 hours, but the hours were unequal lengths originally. Midday can be determined each day, and the timepieces can be checked against the time of midday and reset and correction be made. The datum meridian, I don't think they were reset, is needed as the origin of work to work from, and to be universally manageable, that datum needs a universal assessment. In 1851, George Airy began observing at Greenwich, and it's interesting, Airy disc, with a transit circle, an accurate telescope aligned north-south. From then on, this instrument defined the prime meridian of Greenwich, replacing the previous one, used with other instruments, by its predecessors. The meridian defined by Airy's transit instrument also became the prime meridian for the UK and the basis of the national time. It is used to locate the time at which a star crosses the meridian as it travels from east to west across the sky, the angle for the star above the horizon. From these measurements, the transit of the sun, which is a star, and of other clock stars across the meridian can be used to set clocks at an observatory. In 1884, delegates from 25 nations met in Washington, D.C., the International Meridian Conference. That would have been fun. There were, the Greenwich Meridian was recommended as the official prime meridian. This is getting a bit boring here. For decades, the prime meridian was then understood to pass through Aries transit as the light indicated on the brass, later stainless steel strip. From the courtyard. From late 1999, this has been marked by green laser shining north across the Thames and London at night. What a wow thing. And here's a little picture of midshipman with the thing. However, global positioning positions received now show that the marked prime meridian at Greenwich is not exactly at 0 degrees, 0 minutes and 0 seconds, but approximately 5.3 seconds to the west of this mark. The discrepancy is because GPS meridians are based on the Earth's center of gravity. Oh. Isn't that incredible? That's a bit of a mind bender. Oh, that's interesting. The historic prime meridian is based on a vertical measurement defined by local gravity at Greenwich. As a result, the historic prime does not pass through the center of the Earth, center of gravity, that is, the vertical at which Greenwich does not pass through the center of the Earth. Hence the misalignment of the two meridians. Wow, is that not the funniest thing you've ever come across? That's a joke. Man, that's real. I'm so pleased I read this book. The GPS meridian is defined so the time measured from the prime meridian using the astronomical method exactly the same time as measured from the new GPS meridian using satellite technology. Further complications for meridians and time is posed by the time zones created around the globe, 12 east and 12 west of the prime meridian. The time zone divisions running north and south are often lines that are related to borders and between, in many cases, within countries, but they cover about 15 degrees of longitude, latitude each. Each time zone, the actual correct time that sun occurs only at one meridian. The 360 degree division of circles was an obvious means of dividing the equator into meridians, and these donated east to west a meridian of 0 to 180 degrees rather than running around continually the number of... What? Oh! So you can go 180 degrees east and 180 degrees west rather than that. Now, the point that was made earlier, that midday became the datum as it appeared to remain constant. The problem is it's not exactly constant. Midday actually moves between 14 and 16 minutes or so the other side for an average of the mean time. Why? The Earth's motion relative to the Sun is not a perfect geometry. The Sun's path around the Sun is not truly circular, nor an absolute constant speed. The Sun is not exactly at the center of the Earth's of this path, and neither does it take exactly 24 hours to do rotation, or exactly 365 days to orbit the Sun. In other words, there's a host of tiny upsetting things that together become significant, and so fractional parts have to be added in every now and then. What I love is this is a history book, and this person snuck in all this science. So great. Every now, such a leap day or next day. So, as well as having the meridian slightly out in the wrong place, the actual time the Sun crosses the meridian has its own variation to contend to. And with some patience and maths, the variation can be accounted for. So our elegant time solution actually has come the rough edges to contend with. Time and the Sun clock. Well, I don't know. I think possibly. Time and the Sun clock. In going back to our elegant solution, it's quite simple to figure out your longitude accurately and relatively accurately, which is why the method is so appealing. You need to know a time at the datum point and your own comparison time. Okay, that's the astronomical time. It's got all these other factors in. Having agreed London as the location of the prime meridian at 0 degrees, the location is also became the datum of time, which is initially Greenwich Mean Time, but is now is almost UTC, the almost super accurate UTC, universal, whatever it stands for. Here's how it works. If you know your time, it is in London, and so and also what your time is where you are, you know how many hours, parts thereof, you are away from London. Then you convert this time difference into degrees for longitude to see how many degrees away from London you are. It takes 24 hours for the Sun to go through a full 360 degrees around the world. So, which is correct on this one. That's yep, okay, because the world is actually spinning backwards, so it's actually 53 hours and 56 minutes, and you've got those 4 minutes for the Sun to actually move into the new position. In the pioneering days, the chronometers on board ships working out the exact time where you were could be done, but only once a day, which was good enough at this point. The Sun rises and reaches maximum height in the sky at midday. If you observed the Sun through a sextant and noted the time it was at maximum height above the horizon, your midday and your location, you could then refer to the chronometer carrying the datum of time to see at what time time it was at the location to which your timepiece was set. If it was midnight on the same timepiece, you'd be on the opposite side of the world. If it was midday, then you were at the same place or somewhere along the longitude line north and south. In these days, a GPS with moving dots on our smartphone maps guiding us on foot, and automated voices directing you to driving cars, we take precise location for granted. Ships, clocks, and stars explains the high technology of previous age through complex and beautifully engineered machines and reveals the intellectual sophistication and dogged persistence that once solved this vexing question. So that is a very non-history thing. Now, that's taken me 28 minutes, and I've got to push myself further. Communities on the edge. In the early 20th century, an ambitious engineering project set out to harness the mighty River Murray by building locks and weirs. Historian author Helen Stagg reveals the challenges and community spirit of life on those lock-building settlements. Lock and weir system was going to be one of the greatest engineering activities in Australia, harnessing the River Murray. When there was no water, the Murray just became a series of waterholes and sandbars, Max Pearson. Lock and weir construction resulting from the River Murray Agreement Act of 1915 ensured a reliable supply of water for irrigation and navigation, with the weirs regulating the flow and locks allowing navigation at the weir sites. These lockworks involved large cohorts of men transporting themselves and their families to remote regional locations where they built small, relatively self-sufficient communities on the riverbank for the duration of work before literally pulling up stumps and locating on the next site to begin the entire process again. My grandfather, Arthur Raines, a steam engine driver, was one of these men, and I was growing up, I often heard my mother, Evelyn, vivid memories of her childhood on the locks. During my Master of History from the University of New England, which I completed in 2010, I began investigating the little-known history. My studies gave me the skills and impetus to research and write a book, launched in June 2015, to mark the centenary of the foundation stone of Lock Number 1, Blanchetown in South Australia, harnessing the River Murray's stories from people who built it, who built Lock 1 to 9 from 1915 to 35, to fix the lives of a workforce and women and families whose itinerant lifestyles led them to being referred to as the Great Wandering Class. These are ordinary people, and the book's particular focus is on the children, the women and the labourers from the small town camps at Locks 1 to 9. Locks 10 to 26 and the Yeronga Weir were the responsibility of either Victoria or New South Wales. Okay, this is the South Australian version. No? I don't understand. The first one. Yes, South Australian. As well as detailing the tough and dangerous work conditions, the many accidents that occurred, the narrative ventures deeper into the homes of the people and investigating the fabric of life and how the community supported each other through the good and bad times. Over the 20-year construction period, locks 1 to 9, the nature of the work and the long hours proved no deterrent to the seemingly constant cycle of social and sporting events, including regular dances, movie nights, gala balls, aquatic carnivals, horse races, football, cricket, tennis and soccer competition. With the passage of 100 years, windows into daily lives in the lock camps are limited, and my archival research failed to reveal much about domestic life. Oral history, therefore, combined with letters and newspaper reports, provide valuable information. Many children of the lock workers have now passed on, and my interviews with Max Pearson, Charlie Evans, and Thelma McGuire, Matthew Francis, and Murray Brooks were timely opportunities to record their precious stories. Other eyewitness accounts was made Trelaw's diary and photographs, now in the Murray-Darling Basin Authority's library. Many paid regular visits to the lock camps in the 20s and early 30s to visit her uncle and aunt Bill and Ada Buzzum. My mother's written memoirs are added to the first-hand accounts and together flesh out the documentary evidence. Life on the locks. Arthur Raines and his wife Florence moved to the Lock 5 at Pralinga, South Australia, at the completion of Lock 1 in about 22 with their five children, Evelyn, Leslie, Sydney, Walter and Gladys. Renmark local historian Heather Eppington alerted me to some, oh my god, letters written by the Raines children to the Murray Pioneer newspaper 25-26. This led me to discover a total of 71 letters that the children penned for Young Folks column with, while they were living in Lock 5. The children wrote so prolifically that the columnist, Mopoke, stated in January 26, I must congratulate the Raines children on their steady flow of letters. In addition to precious vignettes of daily life, the letters reveal details of works themselves. For example, on 27th of March 1925, Walter wrote, there are 160 men working here. They work in shifts. They start about quarter to 4 o'clock in the morning and work until half past 12. Another shift goes on then until 20 minutes to 9 at midnight at night. If they have a box full of cement left, sometimes they have to work until after midnight. It's a busy site. Each camp consists of a variety of dwellings laid out in rough streets. Max Pearson recalled, the government provided some houses. They were very, very rough, just wood and iron, but at least they didn't leak, or not much anyhow. They were very primitive in many ways. Evelyn Smith, near Raines, described how the men built an extension on their family. Dad had to always build another room or two, usually from flour bags, which had to be cut open and stitched together. The corrugated iron houses formed an area referred to as Tin Town, while Bagtown, the shanty town on the riverbank, was where others built their homes from whatever materials that were had. Matthew Francis described the house as, quote, built of bags sewn together. My father cut young saplings down for the wood and put up a frame and covered it with the flower bed sewn together. And then he sealed it, painted it to make it waterproof. My mother used to damp the floor to stop the dust of the floor would be covered with tarpaulin. It was just one big room divided by curtains. Most enterprising communities, in most cases, far removed from the established towns, depended largely on produce from the vegetable gardens. They also obtained supplies from visiting paddle steamers, the government store, and small shop at each site. Some had cows, goats, chooks, and supplemented their supplies with fish, ducks, rabbits, bush honey, and mushrooms. Charlie Adams recalled, quote, "Mum made a lot of bread from any surplus bread she sold to anyone who didn't have bread because bread only came in the mail about twice a week." Schools were set up, and the active committees ensured support of the teacher and provision of extracurricular activities for the children. The South Australian Education Department administered the schools at locks 1, 2, 3, 5, up to 6, while the Victorian Education Department did 7 and 9. And the New South Wales Education Department administered the school at lock 9, where the camp was on the state's side of the river. Now, this was meant that many children had to transition between three different states. School systems, as the families moved from one site to the next. At the completions of Lock 9 and 26, when the families were relocated to Lock 4 in South Australia, the school program shifted from Victorian curriculum to the South Australian curriculum, and resultant changes remained in the children's memory. "Every time we changed states, we took us back a year," said Charlie. Marjorie Francis recalled another frustrating aspect. "I was ever having to change the way I wrote. The differences between the state was in capital letters and smaller letters." At all schools, the annual fancy dress concert was an occasion of great enjoyment, and considerable effort was put into a great variety of creative costumes worn by the students. In the 1927 Lock 4 fancy dress concert was attended by more than 70 children in costumes, including Murray Brooks as Dick Wickington and his smaller brother Owen as a toy soldier. 3-year-old Ernie Glenn, who stole the hearts with his Indian costume. In 31, when a massive flood surrounded Lock 7 camp, a diphtheria outbreak claimed the lives of several children, including 6-year-old Ernie Glenn, whose body is taken by the engineer in a boat to Wentworth for burial. Max Pearson remembered the rampant fear throughout the community as anxious parents used various home remedies. Thelma Buclair, Nick Eddy, recalled, "I had diphtheria. I was sick for about 3 weeks. My mother was around all the time. She would burn sulphur, which was a great thing in that day and age. Put a little dustpan shovel and it puts out this terrible smell. It's supposed to kill the germs. I was about 8 at the time. As the Great Depression developed, unease grew around the sites as employment became uncertain. From September 1930, due to the government's curtailment of expenditure, the lock men were put on ration time, and married men received 2/3 of the regular hours and wages. Later, when the 31 flood further impeded works, the men were put on half-time. The residents in Lock 7, Tin Town, found it increasingly difficult to pay their rent. And Arthur Eddy of Lock 7, the Australian Workers' Union representative, lobbied the engineers for a temporary removal of the rent charges. When the rents were withdrawn for a short time, life remained difficult, with the average married man's half-time wage about £2.06 a week. Everly Smith recalled, "Things were so bad in Lock 7, Mum decided to raffle her sewing machine for 3 pence a ticket. The sewing machine was a well-used tool in a woman's household, and Florence Rain's circumstances must have been dire to sell her machine." Max Pearson referred to the times of hardship in a poignant story. Quote, "We were having dinner one night when there was a knock on the door. My mother went to the door. She was cold. She was very cold, and this little girl, all she had on was a thin frock, no shoes, no socks, and said, 'Oh, Mr. Pearson, Mum said I could sell her half a loaf of bread, and she would pay for it.' 'Oh,' my mother said to my father, 'what a terrible world to let little people like that have to live on, live in it so helpless.' Anyhow, she gave the little girl a loaf of bread and a couple of buns and something, and said, 'Tell Mummy, I don't want anything paid for it.' It's things like that that stick in your mind. The community suffered a number of tragedies, including several drownings. Billy McGay, a highly regarded lock worker, was an accomplished swimmer. was just 36 old when he drowned on the 4th of March, 28, while gallantly attempting to rescue a child of a fellow local worker. His death was witnessed by his wife and three children, and he was deeply mourned by all in the lock camp. 100 lock workers were involved in efforts to recover McGlay's body, with many sacrificing a day's pay for the search. The workers then took up a collection for Mrs. McGay and her small family and raised £132 in a very short time. Later they erected a headstone on Billy Graves in Loxton, so the last resting place of their mate was adequately protected and marked for all time and during legacy. The locks workers married, raised families, bonded not only with each other but with the river, always a constant part of their lives. At the completion of locks 7 and 8, many of them moved on to build barges at Goa and the Murray Mouth. Max Pearson recalled the shock of his first sight of ocean as a body of water with no bank on the other side, an inconceivable concept to people whose entire life has been spent on the banks of the Murray. He also described his heartfelt affinity with the river. Quote, "People who worked on the River Murray will always have River Murray flowing through their blood and veins." Similarly, the river embodies these people's legacies as we see these locks and weirs standing strong today. Structures that control the flow of Australia's great waterway, the mighty Murray. Harnessing the River Murray, stories of the people who built the locks, is available of an order on a particular website. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.